I wanted to distinguish compared to other post-storm situations. These are longtime residents. Some of them have lived 5, 10, 20 years in Houston. They have U.S. citizens. So it's something that FEMA needs to address.
Well, we want to thank you for that excellent report, Renee Feltz, Democracy Now! Producer and reporter. And thanks to Chile Iglesias. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Coming up this morning on KBOO. Next, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. They look at how the theft of Facebook data affected the election, and they take your calls. At 9 on Alternative Radio, former Wall Street investor turned journalist Nomi Prince speaks on the inherently unstable economy. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on stage and studio, it's In the Mix, Conversations with Artists Between Races by D.May Roberts, a radio exploration of mixed race. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Eric Bartels welcomes Celeste Noche, whose show Portland in Color is the finale for the Pearl District's UNA Gallery. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee will meet this month on March 22nd at 4:30.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8:01, and coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
This is KBOO, and here is Abe. Hi, Abe.
How you doing? What's up?
Well, what are we doing today?
Putting on a radio show. We do it every Tuesday.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. I, that's good. I'm ready.
Are you?
I am.
Okay.
Okay.
Go.
All right. I don't know where to begin. Actually, this is such a weird time in history.
It is. I was thinking about that as I was doing some preparation last night. I can't really think of an analogous time to this.
No, well, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. No, it's just really weird. We're, you know, I keep crowing on, and you keep remarking on it, about my notions of late stage capitalism and fascism and so
right.
on.
Yeah.
Damn it, I'm right.
No, you're not.
I am.
Capitalism is not in its late stages. I think it's just getting warmed up.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that now that's another, I mean, I wouldn't even argue with that.
Well, that's the argument I put forth before. You called it late-stage capitalism, meaning it's going to terminate in fascism, but I think fascism is just another flavor of capitalism. It just happens that the interests of the state and of the corporate sphere are indistinguishable from
merge, yes. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. Number to call, 231-8187.
Yeah, if you've been paying attention to the news over the past several days, you've probably heard the name Cambridge Analytica.
Oh, Cambridge Analytica. I love them so much.
Why?
Because
why would you love them?
Because they are the evil force that we love in our movies when we look at Star Wars or
no,
something.
No, they're not.
They're not?
No. They're a data crunching firm from the UK.
Yes. I knew that.
There's an article in The Guardian. You can find it on the Guardian's website.
The Guardian, by the way, is a great source.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's been way ahead of the curve on all this stuff. In fact, first started reporting on Cambridge Analytica more than a year ago. The article in question is called, it's subtitled, The Cambridge Analytica Files, and then I Made Steve Bannon's Psychological Warfare Tool, Meet the Data War Whistleblower. And it is the fantastic and fascinating story of a young man, a Canadian, named Christopher Wiley.
Is this the guy with the pink hair?
The guy with the pink
hair. And the
hair.
Nose ring?
And the nose ring.
Okay.
Yeah. It's written by a woman named Carol Cadwallader. Interestingly, she is a co-author on a similar story that ran shortly thereafter in the New York Times. So it appears the Times and the Guardian, as they have at several points in the past, are collaborating on some of this reporting. It's really high-quality reporting. I really urge you to read it. It's a fascinating and depressing story.
So what's the story, Abe?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, an outfit called Cambridge Analytica figured out a way through the administration of personality tests administered on Facebook, a Facebook app that was running on the page.
See, this goes back to my point about being against the internet, but go ahead. Never mind.
That's another point that you're wrong about. But anyway.
Yeah. I'm so right about that.
Taking advantage of some emerging psychological theory and the cooperation of a psychologist with ties to Russia and the Putin regime.
Wait a minute. Ties to Russia and Putin?
And Russia and Putin. Noting correlations between personality and political disposition.
Yes.
And I'm grossly simplifying this.
There's you
a lot,
are.
There's
you
a lot
are
more
indeed,
detail.
But I'm going to let you get away with it.
So this emerging notion in psychology, these two things are related. There was a lack of data, really, to draw some definitive conclusions on these correlations. But Facebook provided an unprecedented platform from which to extract all kinds of data about personality and political leaning.
Are you on Facebook?
I am.
Uh-oh.
Yep.
Well, I don't trust you anymore.
So through the administration of this personality test, where you're paging through your Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Millions of people do this every day. Seeing pictures of cats, seeing people's kids, pictures of people on vacation. Oh, take this personality quiz.
Oh boy, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, and so you take this quiz, and at the end, it asks you, and I'm sure many of you out there may have taken this very test. It asks you for permission to access your Facebook profile.
Oh.
So you can take the test and not click that final button. And you would not have participated in Cambridge Analytica scheme, but many, many people did. And here's the thing. It not only gave Cambridge Analytica access to your Facebook profile, but an inroad into that of all of your Facebook friends as well. So we're talking about literally tens of millions of
cool.
individual users whose data was compromised.
Cool. End of privacy as we know it.
Yeah, the end of privacy as you know it. Facebook, it appears, as we don't really know because they've said very little about this except to say, oh, we didn't sell the data. it appears that it might have been possible. Facebook didn't even know that this was going on.
Yeah, that's true. That's
I think
true.
We will learn more about this in the near future. But it's also clear that Facebook had an inkling that something fishy was going on and didn't do anything to stop it.
That's your Facebook.
That's my Facebook. So all of this data then was put to pretty astonishing use by Cambridge Analytica.
Uh-huh.
To do what, you might ask?
To
create astonishingly precisely targeted advertisements and political content that it then fed to people that reinforce their already existing beliefs based upon this extrapolation that Cambridge Analytica did between personality type and political leaning, all corroborated by tens of thousands of times that each of these Facebook users clicked the like button. Right? So it's real easy to tell what somebody's into if you're able to look at the aggregate collection of millions of times that they've clicked a like button on Facebook, right?
Is this Bannon business?
Bannon was all about this. Bannon met this kid, Wiley, connected him with the people at Cambridge Analytica with an eye to using this to, here's where it gets really interesting, to game not just the 2016 American election, but the Brexit vote.
In Britain.
In the UK.
Ooh.
Yeah.
If I were the British, I'd be very upset.
Yes. it's a fascinating thing. And it appears that this was, if it hadn't been these people at this point in time, it would have happened soon. It was just a data, a low-hanging, big old piece of data fruit waiting to be picked. And we're dealing with the fallout from this. We don't really know yet the extent to which this swayed the outcome of either the Brexit vote or the 2016 election. And also, we should add, the beginnings of this happened in the 2014 midterms in the United States.
Ooh.
We don't know the extent to which this actually swayed the outcome, but I think it's safe to say it probably had at least a measurable effect. And given the perfect storm of circumstances in the 2016 American election, we now have President Trump.
Oh, yes, President Trump.
Yep. And the perfect storm I'm talking about, of course, is this this groundswell of white nationalist resentment that Trump very carefully and successfully exploited.
See, this is a confusing thing about Trump. Now, he's not a very smart man. He's not a very well-educated man. He, in fact, is a kind of a doofus who lies, cheats, and goes bankrupt. And yet, he had advisors and he, who were adequate to figure out how to game the system.
Well, he had smart people working for him.
Yeah.
And I think he has sort of a low cunning, an ability to grasp what people in the room want to hear and an ability to play on their resentments and insecurities.
Sort of analogous to having a stiletto in your hand and you're going for somebody's groin.
No, I wouldn't make that analogy.
Why not?
Because I don't think it works here. But
I think it's pretty close.
Okay. And the other factor, of course, was... I think the unique unlikability of Hillary Clinton. And I say that with a big old asterisk next to it, because it was a very particular subset of the American electorate that despised her above all others on the planet. Now, there are plenty of us on the left who had problems with her and found her to be an unsatisfactory candidate. But that doesn't approach the level of vitriol that a big chunk of the conservative electorate holds towards
Hillary. Is this purely because she was a woman, or is it more to it than that?
No, it's partially because she's a woman, but mostly because she is who she was as a unique personage with her unique history.
Okay.
The former first lady of another despised Democratic figure.
Mm-hmm.
So all these conditions combine to deliver the presidency unto Trump. And let's not forget our antiquated and outdated electoral system.
Right.
Yeah. And the nudge, one might speculate, that pushed Trump over the line was this meddling by Cambridge Analytica funded by the Russian government.
Well, yeah, and by...
And by Steve Bannon and Breitbart News.
And that outfit. What's the name of the money people who...
No, there was one guy, Robert Mercer.
Oh, Mercer, that's the guy.
A conservative U.S. hedge fund billionaire.
Yes.
Right.
The Mercers have meddled a lot.
Yeah. And when we get to the Russian intervention itself, they use this data harvested from Facebook to run their own targeted advertising and disinformation campaign.
Mm. Mm. The Russians are here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. It's, like I said, a fascinating story. And this kid, this Canadian kid... he's full of regret if he is to be believed in this
story.
Well,
I saw him. He looked all unhappy.
Yeah. I think he didn't realize, what his... And it was a stroke of genius making the connections that he did.
Right.
I don't think he believed that it would lead to the outcome that it did.
Right. No, he seems very repentant.
Yeah, well, water under the bridge, dude.
Really?
Water under the bridge.
Really? It's quite amazing. Meanwhile, I'm going to change the subject slightly. We'll come back immediately to this. But
okay.
I just want to mention a couple of things that are so scary. You ever watch Larry Kudlow on CNBC?
Oh, I've never seen Larry Kudlow.
Well, he's a screamer, you know.
Oh, one of those guys?
Yeah, and okay. He is so wrong. He has been wrong in every prediction he's ever made. Actually, literally every prediction he's ever made.
The CNBC is the financial news.
It
network,
is.
Right?
It is okay. The NBC financial news, and it's kind of a rival to others. And it has been amazing. The screaming and yelling thing is part of a phenomenon that is just bizarre. But he constantly predicts things that don't happen. He's been doing this for years. And guess who's decided absolutely to make him the head of the National Economic Council?
President Trump.
President Trump.
Oh, boy.
So this clown, I don't know what else to call him, and maybe he'll sue me, and we can have a clown off, you know.
A clown off.
A clown off, yeah. So anyway, come on, Larry, sue me. Larry is now going to be the economic advisor. He never has had any kind of training in economics, by the way. It's really weird.
That is really weird. But Trump saw him on the TV. And
yeah, that's what Trump sees.
I want that. Give me that guy.
Yeah, that's Trump. Trump really knows everything. Everything he knows, such as it is, comes from television.
Yep.
Weird.
Very weird.
Okay, I want to talk just for a moment about something called supply side. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, we have.
But it's really important to understand. These people all believe that all you have to do is have a system that delivers the goods and that taxes the poor and the middle classes and gives money to the rich, and the consequence of that will be a wealthy, happy society. They don't think anything about demand, like can you afford the refrigerator, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the dominant theme of this administration at this time, and it's disastrous already. That's all. I just want to throw that out there. I mean, we got some of the worst, most ignorant people running the economy from the administration's point of view, and it's going to get a lot worse, because I don't know how the hell you stop this clown unless they finally realize that he's guilty of treason and bust him.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that.
Why?
Because last week, for the first time in the Bob Mueller investigation, subpoenas were issued to people inside the Trump organization itself.
You mean they crossed the red line that Trump said was a red line?
That's right, they did. Now, by the Trump organization, I mean Trump's business sphere, uh-huh. Which really is indistinguishable from either his campaign operation or his White House operation. Because, yeah. Of course, he did not divest himself from any of his holdings when he took office.
See, this is amazing. There's no law requiring that. It's just been
there
custom.
There is a law requiring.
There is a law?
It's the Emoluments Clause.
Oh, the Emoluments Clause!
Of the Constitution that
but
says...
But we hardly ever pronounce the word emoluments.
Well, we have several times in rapid succession here on this program. The Emoluments Clause of the Constitution that says that the president cannot profit personally from his time or her time.
But he has and he
office.
Does.
Yeah, he has and he does. But see, once again, we're led back to the same constitutional cul-de-sac, which is that any constitutional remedy to Trump's misdeeds has to originate in the House of Representatives, which means that our fates rely on the moral rectitude of the House Republicans.
God help us. Well, I don't even believe in God. You know, it's kind of weird.
Oh, I know.
That means there's no help.
All right, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also write facebook.com/AbenJoe.
And we have somebody waiting to get on.
Yes. Marilyn, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
We're well. How are you?
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated by the current political melee. So, I wanted to point out somebody, a dark fandom behind all of this, which is Robert Mercer.
Robert Mercer.
Billionaire.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Robert Mercer. Yes. We remember him. A very rich fella.
He funds Bannon and Breitbart, and he funds Roger Stone, and he funds that skinny lady with the long blonde hair, and her husband also works for him. He's a lawyer for Mercer. I mean, it's, and they're also combined with a bunch of other billionaires in the Midwest Serial, Betsy DeVos.
Yeah, I'm going to. You're breaking up from our end. It's nothing but your equipment. So I'm going to. I would call back when you got a clearer line. I'm sorry. We have to do that. Uh-huh. I think I can't hardly.
Yeah. Any comments on Marilyn's call?
She's telling the truth.
All right, let's go to Paul. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. So I thought your discussion on Facebook, this might be interesting, and I heard this on BBC last night, and I'd never heard this before. So where Facebook and others get most of their money is not from ads, which we all thought. It's from personal data. And I heard they have something like 8,000 data points that, so you know the acronym FUT, it's financial, insurance, real estate. You can add to that health insurance, employment, whether you're employed or not.
Oh, yeah.
So keep that in mind. There's a reason, Joe, you don't go on. I think you're smart not to use it, but
No, that's not it. Joe's just a Luddite. That's why he doesn't use Facebook.
I'm not just a Luddite. I'm beyond a Luddite. I'm a frightened fella.
No, so am I. I don't even use a computer. Anyway.
Okay.
But I do. Oh. If Abe would have run to that, what he's heard, I'm curious.
I'm sorry, seem to be having some trouble with our phones today.
It might be us.
Can you repeat that question, please?
Well, just that Facebook makes most of their money not from ads, but from personal data.
From the sale of personal data?
Yes. That's where they make their money. That was on the BBC last
night. Right. So this is a story that's sort of I think we'd love to let you go due to this phone problem we're having. Apologies.
Sure.
I think it's on our end here. This is a parallel story that's unfolding. Facebook has been making money through the sale of personal data. Personal data is sold all the time, and I'm not justifying that sale. In the case of Facebook, this would seem to me, although I probably will be contradicted if I look in the fine print of the user agreement on Facebook, that people use this platform believing it to be mostly benign, not knowing that their personal data is being aggregated and sold. I feel fairly confident in saying that, making that broad statement. Most people who use Facebook don't do so in the belief that whatever they're doing is being shared for profit with other parties.
I got up and had a shower. Oh, how interesting.
Incredibly interesting. Yeah. Obviously, there's a market for this, and obviously, there's an application for it.
Right.
this story in the Guardian is fascinating. When this initiative was launched, and this attempt to influence political behavior by correlating personality traits and political stances was tested in places like Africa and the Caribbean, where there's virtually no legislation that protects privacy. So Cambridge Analytica was able to give this a dry run, and obviously the results must have been promising enough to put it to work in places like Brexit and the United States midterm and presidential elections.
Well, there is plenty of evidence that the ignorance that dominates the so-called third world is pretty much our ignorance as well.
Yeah, I would say so. But the details in the story, as I've mentioned several times now, are fascinating. This guy Wiley, the Canadian, the kid with the nose ring, was in the UK.
What is it like that? What happens if you have a cold and you have a nose ring?
No idea.
Okay.
He was studying for a doctorate in fashion trend prediction. I didn't know you could get a doctorate.
Of course you can. You can have a doctorate in bead counting. You know, whatever.
But he had this idea. And he found application for it in the fashion world. Like, predicting fashion trends is a very profitable business, right? If you can figure out, you know, ahead of time when something is going to be trendy or when something stops being trendy,
right.
There's a lot of money to be made at that inflection point.
Skirts or pants go up or down.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that transition, that inflection point where the bulk of public opinion sways from one point to another.
Right.
You know, if you're able to accurately predict that, you can make a lot of money. And this kid was realizing, well, he had a background in politics. He worked for the Labor Party in Canada at one point.
Mm-hmm.
He realized that this notion applied to politics as well as to fashion, figuring out where this inflection point was and how to nudge people one way or another. And he talks about meeting Steve Bannon. And this is a quote from the article from Wiley. Bannon got it immediately. He believes in the whole Andrew Breitbart doctrine that politics is downstream from culture. So to change politics, you need to change culture. And fashion trends are a useful proxy for that. Trump is like a pair of Uggs or Crocs, which are ugly pieces of footwear.
Got it.
Trump is like a pair of Uggs or Crocs, basically. So how do you get people from thinking, ugh, totally ugly, to the moment when everyone is wearing them? That was the inflection point he was looking for. So there's some pretty sophisticated thinking going on here.
Unlike Trump.
Yes. Unlike Trump.
Who doesn't know nothing.
But a bunch of people who would go on to work for Trump are doing it. And they're talking about this alchemy of psychology, of technology, of politics, of statistics, of predictive analytics. And it all came together in this company, Cambridge Analytica.
Right. And it has a nice name, Cambridge, you know.
Cambridge Analytica.
Oxbridge and all that.
Yeah. I think in virtually any other context, we would universally be talking about these people as geniuses. But their aims...
Nerdy geniuses.
Their aims were nefarious, and we are all suffering the consequences.
Right, and the next election here is going to be messed up.
Yeah.
And Brexit was messed up. I mean, this is really serious stuff.
Yep. And during the time when this doctrine and practice was taking shape, it attracted the attention of some pretty high-powered investors. The Department of Defense in the United States was very interested in this. The Ministry of Defense in the UK was very interested in this. In fact, the Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency, DARPA, you've heard of them?
Oh, yeah, DARPA.
They actually funded the doctorate of one of the guys who was helping to develop this entire model.
See, now, when I got my doctorate, they didn't fund, DARPA wasn't, well, maybe it was. It wasn't funding anything I got in here.
No, you were doing old boring stuff.
Old boring stuff? Looking at Vice in Portland, for example?
Indeed, boring.
Boring.
Vice has been around forever. So, as I mentioned, go read this article. It's a bang-up piece of reporting and an absolutely compelling story.
I will go online and read it.
Yeah.
I'm not really against the use of the... of the machine, the Google.
You're not against the use of the Google? Yeah, there's
I'm against the broad use of the Google, as in I took a shower today.
Yep. If you want a little bit of a condensed version, a little quicker to digest version of the story, the piece I mentioned on the New York Times, which is called How Trump Consultants Exploited the Facebook Data of Millions. Again, sharing an author, Ms. Cadwallader, with the Guardian piece.
Right.
But it's a little smaller, a little easier to bite off rendering of the story. So.
Yeah, no, I think, do we have callers?
No, we don't.
We don't have callers. Wow, we've driven everybody away.
We have.
That's cool. That means we can dominate the airwaves for the 17 people that are listening.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, I'm amazed at what's going on. And I'm wondering if there is a tipping point where even the corrupt, absolutely corrupt Republicans in the Congress decide they can't stand this horrible, destructive pattern that Trump is exhibiting. I mean, he hires people who are yes men. I don't think he has any yes women, hardly. His yes men, and he hires them regardless of their actual knowledge, but mainly based on the fact that he's seen them on TV and kind of likes them.
It kind of likes him.
And this is the lowest point, intellectually speaking, that we've ever come to in an administration. And we've had some low ones.
You think so? Is it the lowest point, intellectually speaking?
I actually
do. Is it lower than the GWB?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. I actually do. There were big mistakes there. But the fact of the matter is that this guy, just recently, by the way, he decided he's going to, after all, have his war games in Korea.
Yeah, there's that.
He just decided that, which is, you know, actually the big thing that the North Koreans were so pleased about is they got him to hold back on that, and now they're going to do it, and he's gonna somehow meet with Kim. I like Kim. They're going to meet with Kim of the funny hair, and they're gonna talk together about who knows what, and they're going to do who knows what, and it's going to be bad.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Don't worry about it. It's the lives of your children are forfeit, but don't worry.
That's right. Okay, who do we have? Jenny, good morning.
Good morning. Since you're having phone problems, I'll be very brief.
Actually, you sound bright and clear. So, hey.
Oh, okay. We'll see how long that lasts. So, but the topic, of course, is riveting and has some very broad, you know, implications and going to have ripple effect and so on. But while we are on the phone, ho-hum, another high school shooting in Maryland.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I got to go. Thank you.
Goodbye. Another high school shooting?
Yeah.
I don't blame these kids for really being upset.
No, so you can't blame them.
I mean, this is really creepy. This is there's some kind of creepy. And there's the bomb guy.
Oh, the one in Austin?
Yeah, the bomb guy in Austin.
Yeah, bombs going off all over
the bomb
American
girl.
City.
We don't really know the
apparently
sex.
Targeting a prominent African American families in Austin.
Well, it seems the pattern seems to be to go after people of color.
Yeah. These are bizarre times.
These are bizarre times, and they are really, really an indication of the pathology of the American culture.
Who's next? George, good morning.
Good morning. Am I coming through clear?
Yeah, you are.
Okay, I'll be brief. What you're talking about in this manipulation today of ourselves by the powers that be from using stuff from Cambridge Analytica, there's a book by Noam Chomsky called Understanding Power, and Stuart Ewan, later on Captains of Consciousness, wrote a book, and Chris Hedges noted this, and in Chomsky's book, Understanding Power, he just mentions that after World War I, the interest of Edward Bernays and Harold Lasswell...
Oh, Bernays, I know him. He has a very famous sauce.
Yeah, right, you're right.
Ahead.
And Walter Lippmann, this is in the early 20s.
Right.
They started looking at the patterns of consumption, and they started looking at taste, and they started saying, okay, we can manipulate people using advertising, and pretty soon this had gone from not only advertising to we can manipulate people's political behavior. And this was in the 20s. Just thought I'd mention the book, Understanding Power by Noam Chomsky.
No, it's a very good book, and I'm glad you brought it out.
Thank you so much. I'll get off the phone and I want to listen to this program. Thank you again.
Yeah, I want to mention, since Bernays' name came up, we've talked about him before.
We have.
You know, it's not just the sauce.
No.
No. It is, in fact, the beginning of the whole field in advertising, of motivational research and of looking at things where you look at one thing to see about something else. And this was a dynamic that has been dominant in advertising for some time.
Indeed. And I think that this effort by Cambridge Analytica had, or it found in Facebook, virtually the perfect repository, the perfect playing field, as it were, to put its theories into practice. Because users on Facebook tend to not cross ideological barriers very often. There's some fascinating three-dimensional visual renditions of the clouds of people with whom Facebook users communicate. And they are almost always aligned ideologically. So you have this, to simplify or to render it down into our blue and red dichotomy in the United States. You have all the blue people talking to each other and all the red people talking to each other. And occasionally they cross lines to argue, but it doesn't happen very often. And most of the content that they access via Facebook reinforces previously held beliefs.
Right. So there's really no learning taking place.
No, there's just nothing but confirmation bias going on Facebook.
Another reason why I hate Facebook.
Another reason. And there's also the role that Facebook has taken on, I think not voluntarily, as sort of the gatekeeper of the internet. And this in turn is driving down the quality of journalism. And here's what I mean. I don't have the statistics at hand, but a wildly disproportionate amount of website traffic, say to the NewYorkTimes.com,
okay,
is driven by Facebook users, meaning they'll see something on Facebook and they'll click on it and they'll pass through to the New York Times website.
Right.
Or to Breitbart's website or to any number of things. And so the news producers, news organizations began to realize this and said, well, if we want to keep numbers up on our site, if we want to keep our business model going, if we want to attract advertisers to our site, we're going to need to put things up on Facebook that is going to attract people. And this has led to a dramatic condensing of news articles, a dumbing down of content, and the packaging of news articles in such a way as to attract the most clicks.
Right.
So it's an across the board lowering of a journalistic bar.
Right.
Driven by the portal function that Facebook now embodies on the internet. And again, I don't think Facebook came into existence expecting to play this sort of role, but nevertheless, they do.
Well, I don't think it's a conspiracy.
No, not at all. And I don't want to sound like I'm defending Facebook here, because they've acted pretty irresponsibly with regard to everything that happened with Cambridge Analytica. So it's also contributed to the dumbing down of journalism as we understand it.
Right. No more who, what, where, when, how, and why.
No. Meaning, let's sex this up as much as possible,
right,
so that somebody will click on it and visit our site.
Right. It's like the what already happened to TV news. If it bleeds, it leads.
Right. Precisely. So I think we find ourselves, incredibly ironically, at a time when we have more facts and information at our disposal than at any time in human history. But we're misusing it to an incredible degree, and we are misinformed to an incredible degree.
Right, and we have these enormous nodes, I'll call it a node for lack of a better term, of belief that are absolutely based on nothing that is real. You know, and I think a lot of it has to do, beyond the issue of Facebook or whatever, has to do with the kind of mythos that we cultivate in our culture. The God myth, I'm going to say that. People get mad. The God myth.
The God myth.
The God myth, which is universal to all faiths, I think, except perhaps Buddhism. And we are a culture totally actually denying reality all the time. You know, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse as we've gotten more, as you say, as we've gotten more and more and more information. We're information soaked and intelligence deprived.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Yeah, sad.
It's a pretty sad state.
Very sad. Like, we got callers.
We do. Who's next? Ralph, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Yeah, cheer me up, Ralph.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can, because I'm going to take a slightly opposite view.
Well, that's great.
I just want to say off the top that several of Facebook's top people that put the program together and ran it for years now are coming out and saying they have grave misgivings that they've destroyed the social fabric of how we communicate as people, and they just realize they created a monster. And it's not just Facebook, it's all social media that it's affected the way we interact with each other. So there's that. I mean, they're realizing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that worked for Obama during the Obama campaign, Carol Davidson, just came out and said that they basically did exactly the same thing, but that Facebook gave them permission to use the data, and they sucked all of the data off for the campaign, and they still have it, and they haven't been asked to give the data back. So I haven't got my head completely around the Cambridge thing, because it's just come out, but my understanding is that Facebook is in big trouble now because they gave this data, and they didn't. I think the point that Facebook really is trying to get under control is they want to do that for themselves. They don't want somebody else to profit from it. They want to profit from it, and so it's a huge, big mess. But to focus on this one particular thing, I think it's kind of missing the bigger point of, you know, this is going on rapidly all the time.
No, I agree with you, by the way. I absolutely agree with you. Abe and I have this ongoing argument about the internet, and you're just helping me. So thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. I will say that I think this whole Russian thing is, you know, a big pile of dung, and I agree with Ray McGovern that, you know, this is just a political witch hunt. I'm no Trump.
So you don't think Russians have a specific and bad role in our electoral process?
I don't think there's been anything that's been proven, and I just don't think that was the overriding issue that put Trump in the White House. I believe that he's made all sorts of shady deals, including with Russians. But I don't.
We
think
have
that
the meeting with Don
with
Jr. and the Russians. We have the plea deals and statements issued by Papadopoulos and Manafort.
And don't forget Seychelles. It's Seychelles Islands.
It is clear to anyone paying attention that the Trump campaign.
Right. Well.
And Russian intelligence. Go ahead.
Let me ask you this. Let's just say that, you know, there might be something there, which I think you're it's a big nothing burger. But I can name a country that basically people have to kiss up to or they won't get elected, period. And you probably know what that country is.
I don't think I do.
They have to grovel before...
Before the United States, yes, but that's not a refute. That's not a refutation of the Russia connection.
Jeff Merkley took money from a group, and he had to give it back because they said you give that money back, or you're not getting elected. And you remember that at all?
No.
But again, this doesn't disprove or refute collusion with the Russians.
I see, but what I'm saying is there, you know, there's other, and not to say that we don't, you know, meddle. So, you know, for us,
oh my goodness, we have a history of meddling since the Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah, and you know, and also let's not forget, you know, Operation Mockingbird, where the CIA pretty much provides data, you know, or reporters or whatever for the press. I mean, that's ongoing. Okay.
No, I appreciate that point. I also think that it, for example, that the fact of the matter on the whole cocaine epidemic, which morphed into the narcotic epidemic of today, really was a CIA operation. I'm convinced that's true, and I'm convinced that we have been bad boys all over. Not many bad girls here. Bad boys, and it's
well.
It's
Why are we still in Afghanistan? Why is the poppy crop at record, amounts?
Yeah.
You know, why did we go? Why did we so-called liberate Kosovo, who were the drug runners into Europe? It's so corrupt. It defies, you know. It just
well,
stuck
I mean,
about, you know,
I think I agree
world.
With you that there's plenty of corruption to go round. I don't think it has a national meaning. That is, I don't think Afghanistan, which is really a tribal nation, or for that matter, Kosovo, are the key. I think the key is, I'm still going to have to say this, the key is money, and we're watching this whole thing go down.
And the banks... The banks survive on laundering drug money. Right.
No, I'm not going to even argue with that. The banks are made of marble with a guard at every door. Listen, I'm going to let you go.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people hanging out, I hope.
Yep.
Thank you.
Speaking of money, I want to turn back to this Guardian piece for a second.
Sure.
Because as I mentioned, the details here are fascinating. Robert Mercer, with his millions of
dollars. Mercer. Isn't that something you do with cotton?
No.
Yes, it is. Mercerations.
Okay.
Cotton thing.
I know.
Thread.
I was just
you make thread.
Yeah, I was just trying
stronger to
just paper over whatever it is you're trying to do.
Okay.
Mercer, a rich guy, conservative ideologue, also a very smart computer guy. It's how he made his money.
Uh-huh.
At one point in the article, they say that, you know, in politics, usually the money guy is the dumbest person in the room. He's just there to give money. But in Mercer's case,
Not so.
Not so. Okay, so I mentioned earlier the Russian psychologist who was in on this. There's the Russia connection. Is Dr. Kogan was his name.
Kogan.
Okay, so Robert Mercer's Millions, I'm reading now from the Guardian piece, Robert Mercer's Millions created a firestorm. Kogan was able to throw money at the hard problem of acquiring personal data. He advertised for people who were willing to be paid to take a personality quiz, at the end of which Kogan's app, called This Is My Digital Life, gave him permission to access their Facebook profiles. And not just theirs, but their friends too. On average, each seeder, the people who had taken the personality test, around 320,000 in total, unwittingly gave access to at least 160 other people's profiles too, none of whom would have known or had reason to suspect. I'll read one more paragraph here. What the email correspondence between Cambridge Analytica employees and Kogan shows is that Kogan had collected millions of profiles in a matter of weeks, but neither Wiley, he's the pink-haired kid, nor anyone else at Cambridge Analytica had checked that it was legal. It certainly wasn't authorized. Kogan did have permission to pull Facebook data, but for academic purposes only. What's more, under British data protection laws, it's illegal for personal data to be sold to a third party without consent. Facebook could see it was happening, says Wiley. Their security protocols were triggered because Kogan's apps were pulling this enormous amount of data. But apparently Kogan told them it was for academic use, so they were like, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So Facebook was at least tacitly involved here. They didn't stop what was going on. They knew what was happening. But they, I guess, couldn't be bothered to do any more investigation.
Well, you know my position on this.
I do.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, thanks for taking my call. Interesting show. I'm going to connect a lot of dots here and not take up too much time, hopefully.
Go for it.
So you started talking about, well, first of all, let me ask this question. Facebook obviously sucks. And we use Facebook, those of us that are activists, to try to connect with communities and to push information out. And yet we don't know what's going on when we push out. It goes into a black box and we have really no control over where it goes.
And apparently that's so, yeah.
Facebook limits where it goes because they want to get paid for it to go out. So my question is, the provocative question this morning is, what would we do if Facebook didn't exist?
Well, I suspect that we would go on with our lives.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I want to respond to that. I actually think that our lives would not be that much changed, except that we would be less able, the powers that be would be less able to manipulate us. And that goes to the heart of an argument that Abe and I are always having.
Sorry.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think we would actually reconnect our communities in ways that we're not now doing, because we think we can, you know, learn about each other through online. So enough of that. You mentioned God myths, Joe. I want you to also know Unitarians don't have a God myth.
Well, they have the Unitarians have sort of my religious belief, which is that it's the notion of ineffable. We know there's something out there, but we have no idea what it is.
And there's atheists too who are Unitarians who don't believe anything's out there. Unitarians do not have a God myth.
Okay. I don't know, but okay.
I'm telling you.
Okay.
Then you talk about myths. We talked about myths. You also mentioned myths. The myths that I think are so important for people to understand. Daniel Quinn, author of Ishmael, died about 3 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote about mythology in a way that, you know, changes people's paradigms. We're all caught in the myth of this culture. And until we can break out of it, we're stuck in a system that compels us to go on killing killing the earth in order to survive, and that's a dead end street.
Well, I actually agree with you.
Thank you. And I hope people will check out Daniel Quinn, such an important voice to what's going on. And then lastly, I just got to say this Russian thing. It's so much nothing. 18 months they've indicted, you know, 13 Russians who will never come to the U.S. to face the charges. Just because they indicted them doesn't mean they're guilty of anything. And secondly, the people they've indicted in the U.S. are people they weren't indicted to anything to do with Russia. They were indicted on lying to the FBI, which is what all people get caught up in. If you say, hey, I think I wore a blue shirt. And you
lying to the FBI about the Russian connection. I disagree with you. This is not a nothing burger. This is something. And this may be what ultimately brings down the Trump presidency. Listen, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. What would happen if Facebook goes away? That was a very good question.
No, it is a good question.
Nothing would happen with you because you don't use it.
Right.
I
use it occasionally.
Right. So for me, the value in Facebook is that, you know, you're born, you grow up, you make a bunch of friends who are very important to you at an early time in your life. And then a lot of times you move away, they move away, you lose contact.
Right.
That's just life. But through Facebook, I've been able to reconnect with all kinds of people whom I probably would never have spoken to or seen again ever in my life. And these are not people that I need to be close, personal, everyday friends with. But it's really nice to see how they're doing, to see pictures of their kids, of their spouses.
That's
to learn
so
how
warm.
They're doing.
That's so
it
warm.
Is.
That's so sweet.
Now, I know you're being incredibly cynical and mocking, but it is true. It is
warm.
I am
being cynical and mocking, yes.
It is warm, and it is nice, and it does, I believe, it has added some value to my life.
Okay.
Because it has allowed the reestablishment of those connections that were lost a long time ago.
I prefer to go to the movies.
Yeah, I know you do. So that's nice. And if that were to go away, I'd probably miss that, but it wouldn't be radically different from the way life was before Facebook.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
In that respect.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Barry, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Is this Abe?
Yes.
Yes. I mispronounced a word last time. I have a termite. It's termite.
Termite. Yes.
But,
mm-hmm.
Yes. But about government, it's a Moscow thing. I don't believe it. It doesn't make good sense. But then last week, I think it was Mr. Putin mentioned something about the Israelis, and this reinforces something that I have been concerned about, how the people in the upper people in the Israeli government have had a lot of pretty bad stuff to do. One was they do get into other people's governments. One example given was Austria, how someone was killed there for having.
Well, look. Governments play around with each other, and they play around at a lot of different levels. That's certainly true. The notion that there is some kind of incredible power coming out of Israel is a fiction, and largely, I think, an anti-Semitic fiction. Israel is a government that has moved away from the ideals of the original Zionist state. Israel was even founded on a fantasy, which was that somehow Palestine had no people in it, and that the surviving Jews had no land, and therefore the two could be merged in some kind of legitimate form.
No.
Yes, that's really the propaganda that I grew up with.
The door.
What?
To the door, I'm in a hospital.
Oh.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm going to have to move on to someone else.
Yes, but...
Yeah, no, I think that's necessary. Okay, so it's 231-8187. Who do we got? Go ahead. Jared.
Hello.
Oh, yes, you're loud. Go ahead.
All right. Hey, according to Wikipedia, the Mercer family are part owners of Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
That's correct.
I didn't know if you guys had mentioned that yet. So.
No, we had not made that point, but you're absolutely right, and it's no big surprise.
So, all right. Well, you guys have a good one.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Where I think we're going, and I think where people need to understand, is that the fundamental ideas about democracy, which were put together by the founding fathers, no mothers, of course, the founding fathers, were in and of themselves faulty. They in order to create this nation, they had to tolerate slavery. They had to create a system, in fact, which gave disproportionate power to the slave states, all kinds of things like that. Now, despite all that, there was a reasonable perception, not necessarily always true, that we were functioning in a democracy. That perception now has crumbled. The fact of the matter is that with modern technologies and modern money, you cannot expect that there is an actual democracy. In fact, even the efforts to create a left-wing political party becomes totally corrupted. If you look at what happened with Jill Stein, she was manipulated by the Russians too. So, you know, it's really hard to have a system that goes to the heart of people's reasonable thinking under these conditions, which is one of the reasons why I am very dubious about the internet.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
You give that up to me. Okay.
Susan writes into the Facebook page to say, loved your comments about Facebook and social media contributing to the dumbing down of journalism. Absolutely true. My question, do you think it might be possible that a revolt against news on social media will come about with a return to quality journalism? It's possible, but not probable.
Not at all. No. I've done journalism off and on over the years. I've published a lot in the Oregonian, believe it or not. I published quite a bit in the early days of Willamette Week before it became whatever it is now, and other publications as well. And I actually think that what has happened to journalism is a move away from even the most, and by the way, journalism was never a very high art in our culture, but we've moved away from whatever it was before. When I mentioned earlier the notion of who, what, where, when, how, and why, you know, that is not, you just read almost any article in almost any publication, particularly, for example, the slime that is now the Oregonian, and you really are hard put to answer those kind of questions within the first three paragraphs of the reading.
That's true.
So it's all really quite dismaying. However, I am not ready to give up the game. I do believe that people are smart. I do believe they can wake up. I do believe that the grotesqueness of this current administration is even scaring people on the right. And in fact, I see it in the Senate. And I do believe that the consequence of this will be eventually, I hope, the absolute dismissal of the insanity that it constitutes the Trump administration.
Yeah. And circling back to Susan's question a little bit, you know, is it possible we might see a return to quality journalism? It's possible.
Well, there is quality journalism.
There is.
The Guardian, for example.
It's out there, yeah. But you know, how do we get people to point themselves towards it rather than the less quality alternatives? And part of the answer, I think, lies in something that you've mentioned on the show time again, which is the importance of a broad-based liberal arts critical thinking education that begins, you know, long before the university level. And I would add to that, I think, that it's necessary now to include media literacy among the basic core curricula that our students learn as they grow.
I think you're right. I think that's a good insight.
Basically, how to recognize good journalism from bad.
Or how to recognize truth from falsehood in news.
Yeah. That's a pretty tall order,
yeah,
I think. But yeah, it is possible. You're absolutely right.
Well, and also remember all the things that go into this. I just saw the movie Trumbo again.
Mm-hmm.
About Dalton Trumbo, who was blacklisted, and he's a great writer. Was a great mm-hmm. writer. The fact of the matter is, the country goes crazy. It goes crazy out of paranoia, and is encouraged in that process by mostly right wing, so far, right wing efforts. And it's really hard to peel back those madnesses, particularly if people are uninformed. And as you mm-hmm. suggest, uninformedness constitutes the popular culture of our age.
Yeah, it does.
And that's really very sad.
And if we're being fair, probably the popular culture of past generations as well.
Yes.
Yeah. John writes in to say, with all the gerrymandering, voter suppression, cross-check, etc. practiced in the U.S., Russia had to be at best a minor player in the last election. However, the influence of the Russians on this regime is yet to be fully disclosed. I think that gets to the meat of what my interest in the Russia collusion is. It's not clear yet whether Russian meddling delivered the election into the hands of Donald Trump.
No, I think there were a number of factors.
There are a whole bunch of factors. But that's really irrelevant. That's really not the important case in point here. The important case in point is that a major presidential nominee knowingly and actively colluded with a hostile power. Whether or not that collusion had an effect is irrelevant. That is something that should be unacceptable.
Well, I take it a little bit differently than you. I think there was at one point, given the closeness of this peculiar election and the bad structure we have in national elections, I really do think the Russian collusion is a significant factor.
Well, I think we will know one way or another when this is all sorted out.
When will that be?
I don't know.
Okay.
Here's a useful barometer, yes, when assessing this. The louder and more hysterical and more frequent the president's tweets are, that indicates that Mueller is getting closer and closer
to
the truth.
Yeah, and actually that's a good barometer. Yeah. The crazier the president becomes in his tweets, the closer and closer he is to indictment.
Yes, indeed.
I like that.
It's very true, yeah.
Pretty soon we'll go, and we'll all know he's down.
The madder he gets on Twitter, the closer to the truth, whatever it is.
And madder is not just angry, it's crazy.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think we're done. I think we're out of time.
We've run out of time. Yeah. I hope people have enjoyed this. I hope it's been informative. We want you to stay tuned to KBOO. Best in news, best in public affairs, and best in music.
Yes, and a Luddite talk show host.
Yes, that's me.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. The time now is 9 o'clock. Coming up next on Alternative Radio, former Wall Street investor turned journalist Nomi Prinz speaks on the inherently unstable economy. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on Stage and Studio, it's In the Mix, Conversations with Artists Between Races by D. May Roberts, a radio exploration of mixed race. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Eric Bartels welcomes Celeste Noche, whose show Portland in Color is the finale for the Pearl District's UNA Gallery. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon World Water Day, celebrated on Thursday, March 22nd. Environment Oregon and Oregon Environmental Council are organizing a statewide celebration of World Water Day.